Welcome to Veterans Connected, where maintenance and reliability expert and military veteran Eric Bevavino connects with fellow veterans in industry during each episode, exchanging their experiences and discussing the transition from the military to industry and the resources that led them to where they are today. The Veterans Connected podcast is proudly produced by the industry's leading network and learning community, Mobius Connect. Eric, over to you.
Hi, I'm Eric Bevavino, host of the Mobius Connect podcast, focused on connecting military veterans to the maintenance and reliability community. Our aim here is to bridge the understanding gap between the military and civilian worlds, thereby improving the veteran transition experience and ultimately providing hope and a helping hand to any of our brothers and sisters out there struggling to find their way. We'll do this by interviewing veterans who have successfully made it through. For this session, we've chosen to interview one such Navy veteran, Kelvin Gardner, whose fascinating and patriotic story is a must-listen for anyone interested in joining us on this mission. Hey, Kelvin. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, how are you doing, Eric?
Doing great. Doing great. It is like 60 degrees in central Kentucky. We had a big rainstorm last night. And where are you coming to us from?
Aiken, South Carolina, and then we also are around 70 degrees, you know, one of those warm-ups before it gets cold again and then warms up for summer.
I don't know if the flu is going around where you're at, but half of my household is down with the flu, and we're keeping our fingers crossed that we don't get it, but yeah.
I hope you stay away from that.
Yeah, you too, buddy, you too. We all got to stay healthy, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So, Kelvin, we were connected through LinkedIn. I noticed on your profile that you have a maintenance and reliability business. And I've been looking forward to this interview ever since we had our intro call. Lots of great territory to cover, especially for those interested in the maintenance and reliability space. So why don't we start with who you are, what you do today, and then we'll dial it back to the early years. That's okay.
Yeah, that's fine. I'm Kelvin Gardner. I'm a dad, a husband. Right now, I work as the main principal of my business, Faithful Reliability, where I mainly do inspections and also do consulting. And just to go backwards a little bit, I have certifications in as a vibration analyst, ultrasound technician, a motor circuit analysis. Pretty much all of the predictive technologies that are used today in condition-based monitoring, I have or have used. But right now, like you said, I run my own business and I work in the maintenance and reliability field. After many years of working for certain companies like Bridgestone and Amazon, I decided to go on my own and help where I can in this industry. As some people may see by my later in life age now, I don't have to work as a full-time person anymore, but I'm enjoying working what I do when in the maintenance reliability era like I do now.
Fantastic. And I love how you introduced yourself as a father and a husband. And really, that's the identity that matters at the end of the day. And I think it's something that as veterans may take some time to sort of shed the shield of I'm a Navy diver or a Navy nuke or petty officer or lieutenant or whatever. And that's really what matters at the end of the day. So fantastic. So, okay, you're running a maintenance and reliability business, doing predictive inspections, I guess, and consulting around particular areas of maintenance and reliability, or sort of the whole gambit of maintenance and reliability.
It's right now is due to the explosion of AI and other technologies, IoT, certain things like that. In my last few years of working, I became more exclusive to the wireless vibration sensor technology. And between those right now, I'm consulting companies that want to put their toe in the arena of wireless technology, but they're not sure what they don't know. So I come in and kind of explain what they have, take a look at what they have and what they need, you know, try to be maybe the liaison between them and a vendor or a salesman that jumps in and wants to sell them a whole gamut of condition-based technology. But I try to explain to them, you know, the limitations, what you need and what you can get from it, or what you want to get from it and what they actually can provide from it. And but also, I also go in and do inspections. I don't like to say I do full-blown inspections, but my goal is to help companies help themselves go in and do inspections, but hopefully take one of their maintenance technicians or a millwright and say, hey, come along with me for a few months, and then let them catch the bug or vibration or whatever and say, hey, you know, leverage that against that company and say, hey, start sending me some of these certifications and we can do this in-house instead of hiring a third party company to do it. Have someone who has onus to the equipment and then do the inspections themselves.
Fantastic. So it's really a transfer of knowledge versus a, hey, I'll come in and you're going to depend on me for the, you know, for the next 10 years and all that. I love it. Yeah.
Absolutely.
I mean, train the trainer, running mate, sort of program comes to mind from the Navy. You pick up somebody and show them what they don't know or how cool it can be. Yeah,
absolutely.
Fantastic. So you mentioned Amazon and Bridgestone. Were you working in the reliability space for those companies on a production floor or warehouse floor, or were you leading or sales or marketing? What did you do for those folks?
For my great company of Bridgestone, I actually worked for them for 18 years.
Oh, wow.
I started with them as an actual a maintenance guy, maintenance technician. And through the years, 18 years, I worked my way up from a maintenance guy to a planner to a scheduler of PMs. And then lo and behold, right at the end of my time there, I got into reliability with the predictive technologies, where they sent me to most of my certifications in vibration, ultrasound, oil analysis, and motor circuit analysis, where we were, you know, it was a culture changing, just, you know, tried to make better the PMs to actually make the machine actually go from, I guess, calendar based to a more like condition based as we are now. But it was the beginning of that, and that's where I started that career with them.
Fantastic. And
yeah.
What a great place, right? Tire manufacturing, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
Yeah. And all types of tires, or mostly car tires or truck tires or big, small. What kind of tires were you involved in?
Well, here in Aiken, they were manufacturing passenger tires, going from the smaller, like a small tire on a small sedan, like a Civic or something, up to large, like a 20-inch tire. But they were all passengers from small sedans to up to the larger SUVs were the tires that we covered. And we were responsible. Back when I worked for them, they were up to manufacturing up to 37,000 tires a day.
Wow. Wow. Incredible. I had the pleasure of working when I first came out of the Navy. I joined Castrol Industrial, and I worked for a gentleman. His name was Chuck Barrett, and he grew up in Akron, Ohio.
Oh, okay.
Home of the tire business back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And I was able to, in the role of a lubrication specialist or lubrication engineer working for a lubrication company, had the pleasure to be sort of mentored by him and others, folks in tire plants, through the tire manufacturing process, which is pretty heavy duty, very intense, a bunch of interesting machines, from mixers to calendars to extruders to presses and everything else. So that's awesome experience. So let's dial it back. Like, you did your years in the Navy, you know, you weren't working on tire presses when you were in the Navy. I don't think there are any tire presses in the Navy. If there are, maybe they're on tenders, but I kind of doubt it. Where did you grow up? What sort of influences did you have on your life? And then, how did that lead you to the Navy?
Well, I mean, Funny thing is, the Navy took me away from home, but I grew up actually here in South Carolina in a small rural town called Allendale. I grew up as that I want to say that stereotypical, like my wife is a teacher, she describes it as a stereotypical little boy that always wants to take things apart. I was that kid growing up wanting to know, I wasn't good enough with riding my bike. I wanted to know how did my bike brakes work and taking them apart and then putting them back together. That's the kind of kid I was growing up. And, it grew from that to taking apart, messing with vehicles with my uncles, taking apart engines and putting them back together, not doing it with, I mean, just helping them, but also learning at the same time, which I guess that laid the foundation of how I actually, that's the way I teach and prefer to train people now, like to show them, what they don't know and then the cool ways of learning from my hands-on. But yeah, just growing up as a small town, was planning on going to college. Like we may have discussed earlier, my mom, single mom, didn't have enough money. I got a scholarship, but it wasn't gonna be enough. I had two younger brothers, and my mom, single mom income, I didn't want to burden her with trying to help me pay for school and take care of my little brothers back at home. So I decided I'm gonna go off in the Navy because I read that, you can join the Navy and they take care of your education and you can see the world. So that's where the gumption or the need or request or the want for joining the military. Now, it was kind of point at, I was introduced to all four branches and I made my decision after doing a little research before just jumping in on any of them.
Well, it sounds like it comes from true inspiration and a desire to help and respect for your mother and your brothers and everything like that. And boy, from what you told me before, did you get an education? I know people who are listening, they're like, okay, yeah, he probably used the GI Bill and went to college, but you got extra training.
Yeah,
How did
I got a little
tell us
bit.
about that? Yeah.
Yeah, that extra training came via the nuclear field program because after, when you are applying for the military, you have to take the ASVAB. And then I had a very on top of it recruiter that realized I scored not exceptionally high, but high enough to own the ASVAB to qualify for the nuke program. And he said, "Are you ever thought about that?" And then, kid growing up, only thing I knew about nuke was the I don't know if Plant Vogtle was down where we actually live, and all I remember seeing, if I remember seeing of nuclear power was always seeing the cooling tower and actually having a complete wrong idea what nuclear power was from these cooling towers, thinking those had something to do with the reactor, but actually they just provided, cooling sink. But we can talk about that later. But yeah, I joined, went in boot camp and went on to A school, and I was selected to be in the nuclear field program. And because I was in the nuclear field program, you have to give, instead of 4 years, you have to give 6 years because they send you to accelerated school for 2 years of your enlistment. And that first starts off as A school, which is a year and a half of, or a year of advanced, my field was electronics. So I had to go to nuclear field A school right there in Orlando. And that was the beginning of it. But the exciting part was the nuclear program part of it, what we call power school. And to sum it all up, it's more like they took 4 years of college and slammed it into a year and a half or 2 years and said, I always try to tell like my daughter, her friends, that meme of that little girl trying to drink from a fire hydrant, that is truly what nuclear fuel power school is all about right there. They're pumping out so much information and they want to see who can retain, who can regurgitate, but mostly is to retain and understand of the basis of it. But that's where my Navy began in the nuclear fuel power school in Orlando and A school right there in Orlando. And then of course, after everything you learn in theory, you have to go off and prove it in some type of on the job training, which is what they call prototype, where you go off and they send you to a place that you can practice and train on an actual reactor. And my selection was there in Charleston, South Carolina. Now, this is, you know, because of my age, this is way back when Jay just had moved prototype to Charleston. And from my understanding, I think that's one of the main prototypes nowadays right there in Charleston, because it houses most of the facilities for it. And what you trained on was a ballistic submarine, which they cut out the burning sections of it, welded it back together, and let a bunch of 18-year-olds run a nuclear power plant up and down for drills over and over and over the training.
With some adult supervision, right?
Yeah, there was some adult supervision.
What could go wrong? 18-year-olds in a nuclear power plant submarine. Yeah. Well, it had the benefit of being close to home, too. I'm just curious. I mean, looking back at it now, when you were 18, you're like, okay, I joined because, you know, I'm looking for education. Was it just like, oh, yeah, well, I got what I asked for? Or were you like, holy crap, this is like a lot more than I thought it was getting? Or was it just like naturally, like, I joined for this, I got this, I'm good? Or were you like, wow, this is pretty intense? Or you just took it all in stride? I mean, how did it feel?
At first, in the beginning days, it was overwhelming. It was good. But like you said, I mean, this is the ironic thing, was I was going to go to college for engineering, mechanical engineering. And then basically, you know, I don't know, a lot of people notice the second half of nuclear field power school is all basic, from the basics of engineering up to the advanced part of it, when you're, you know, dealing with the fusion and the reactions in the reactor. But, you know, I went from hopefully I get education as an engineer. When I got it within, you know, in 6 months in power school, I was already ahead of some. I say this with a grain of salt. I was ahead of some engineers that were in college, you know, still living their best life. But I was, you know, getting all that, you know, education on the what I didn't know was to come, was going to be used, you know, in real life.
Yeah, fantastic. You know, I don't know if the Navy gives degrees for that kind of training, but they should, or they should consider it as a, you know, an accredited institution. And I mean, come on. But anyway, awesome. Great. So you went to prototype, and then did you get assigned to a surface or a submarine after that?
I got assigned to the big target, the surface. I went to aircraft carrier, USS George Washington, which was actually being pre-commed in Newport News, Virginia.
Nice.
And for those who do know or don't know, pre-com means it was just being built. It was in the construction phase. And, you know, looking back at it, like I like to do things, that probably was the best time for a brand new person right out of a nuke power prototype to get in there. And you get to see, you know, things that you wouldn't see if you were just assigned to a ship that was already been at sea for a while, whatever. But you get on the theory side, you get to see, you know, parts of the reactor coolant loop or reactor coolant pumps or things like that. But, you know, I'm sorry, I'm nerding out a little bit, but
no, it was pretty it's cool okay. And exciting. Yeah. So, I mean, this is kind of news to me too, because I was on two very old boats that were decommissioned while I was on them. So I never saw the pre-commissioning process. Did you actually, was the ship was still kind of, the final touches were being put on it, and what you're describing is you got to see some of the internals as they were built that you wouldn't normally get your eyes on. Okay. You would only see them in like books or, you know, it's behind this pump is behind this big casing, and I have to imagine that there's an impeller in there or, you know, the bearings and everything like that. But that is cool. That was a great experience too, I bet. Yeah.
It was. And because of that early part of it, will allow us to see those parts that you would never see because of things getting irradiated and being dangerous afterwards, was because when there was always initial testing that has to be done, which were like hydrostatic testing, which I always go back to was the key to what I really fell in love with when I got on the ship. And that's the part I love. back then, when you were a non-qualified person, you had to stand these little watches, which when meant when they were hydrostatically testing the coolant loops or any piping that supplied coolant or provides supplemental protection for the reactor. The hydrostatic testing means that they tested the piping up to certain operational pressures and pressures that it was designed to withstand in the case of supposed accidents. Mm-hmm. But so in that case, you were in places in the ship that you would never be in during a normal operating time. You were right next to, or, you know, a three-story tall reactor coolant pump, or you were right next to this check valve that you found out later that, you know, why it's, you hear that slamming noise when you start and stop coolant pumps because of the size and the flow rate in which it, you know, moves coolant. Things like that, what you learn in those early days of pre-com.
Neat. Well, that must have been a pretty cool experience. I got a mechanical engineering degree. I love to take things apart. My challenge is sometimes they don't all go back together the way they're supposed to. So I need to really take my time and kind of lay them out. And but it's all good. All good. Great. Well, it sounds like that was a fantastic foundation for you. Did your entire time on active duty remain with the GW, or did you do anything else, or did you hit that time and then you transitioned out to, of the military? What happened next?
Well, next was I got qualified, which is, you know, which is things, what I always say is the one good thing about the military is you had to work your way up the ladder, which I always preference to the civilian world. You have to, it was, you start somewhere on one part on the ladder and you work your way up. So I got qualified all the way up to reactor technician, which is a senior watch station. You oversee the startup and shutdown of both reactors in a carrier. But as we spoke earlier, I was one of those special cases because there was no more individuals qualified as at my position or for electronic technician. I was selected to be extended throughout the through the Navy. So my EOS was coming up and I actually got extended. And like we talked earlier, before I told you, it was kind of like a mini court martial. That day came, I had to go up and see the captain, and they were explaining to me that the need of the Navy rose over, you know, me getting out.
So. That was a funny story. The way you led up to it, like Captain's Mass, you get all dressed up. You're like, oh, like I haven't done anything wrong. Why am I going? Captain Mass is usually a negative thing.
Yeah.
And in this case, the stop loss program, you know, was in effect. And they said, okay, Kelvin, I know you're looking forward to your next phase in life away from the Navy, but we're going to hang on to you. Forcefully hang on to you for a while, and you're a good guy, and we want to keep you until we can train more people to, you know, fill the gap. I remember talking to you about this and being sort of amused by the story, right? Because knowing the stress that comes along with this captain's mask is usually negative, but it sounded to me when you related to this before that you're like okay, cool. You know, good. Yeah, I like what I'm doing. I'll do it for a couple more years.
Yeah, I mean, to kind of tie it all together, like, you know, what your podcast is about with veterans transitioning. To be truthful, Eric, I wasn't ready. I wasn't ready to transition out, even though I was, you know, it was time for me to leave. It kind of, I mean, now that once again, I always say this, now that I look back at it, it was a mini blessing. It truly was, because I really hadn't prepared. I hadn't done anything to get myself out. So I was going to step out of the Navy and step in the civilian world with nothing ready to go. So when this extension happened, it kind of was an eye opening, like you need to get ready. And also you need to make sure people that are taking your place are qualified and up to snuff. So you don't want to, you know, like my grandfather used to tell me, leave things better than what you found it.
Worse to live by, for sure. So blessing in disguise that you weren't expecting.
Yep.
And okay, so then you fulfilled your obligation for a couple more years. And did that, like, what did you do to take advantage of this extra time and now maybe a reset? Okay, now I have the time to look.
Well, during that time, I actually, this is also ironic. I didn't tell you about this part is after I got extended, I was there for maybe six more months. And then I got transferred. George Washington was about to start another deployment, and they really didn't want me to go out with them. So I got transferred. I actually got transferred to the USS Stennis. And that, which oddly enough, was another ship that was in the middle of pre-com. So I was transferred basically to do what I've always done all my life, to transfer knowledge to the new guys coming on to the Stennis. So I went over to the Stennis, went through all my quals pretty fast because I was already qualified. And I remember walking on board and had to go see the captain of the reactor department. And he made it pretty clear that he said, I understand. I know your background. I know you were extended once. I know that you're probably coming over here. You may be a little disgruntled, but I need your knowledge to be, you know, passed on to these future reactor operators because, you know, this is truly the future. So, you know, by him taking the time to speak to me one-on-one and making me understand that it was going to be, the picture was bigger than just me. I took that full advantage and I spent the last, I think, year of my time in the Navy on the Stennis just qualifying and making sure everybody knew exactly what to do in any case and to be the best they could. And also, I took that time to also do research about, you know, civilian world. That's when I started looking into, do I want to transition into the civilian world of nuclear power? Or do I just want to go do maintenance and mechanical stuff on the outside? So that's where it all started right there at the end, around 1996, 97, when I was actually prepared to get out of the Navy.
Nice, nice. Well, that, for our listeners, that provides some insight, right? Insight and, okay, you've got a couple years left. You're moving on. You've passed all these wickets. You're really, I also enjoy the fact you say that my purpose in life is to help other people learn and to leave it in a better place than we found it, which is a higher evolution that not everybody makes it to. I'm trying to strive to get to that place myself, but yeah, the universe conspires in weird ways and, you know, it doesn't seem like it makes sense at the time always, but it, when it comes through, it comes through. So, okay. So you considered your options. You learned maintenance from probably the best maintenance school in the world, the U.S. Navy Nuclear Power Program in engineering and in leadership. You got a chance to lead. And on multiple occasions, but most especially towards the end, where you were getting people up to snuff and qualifying them and teaching them what you knew. Where did that take you after that?
Well, then I during that time where I was right about to get out, you know, I was introduced to the, what was it? Are you going to forgive me? You probably remember. All I remember is the TAP.
Transition assistance program.
Yeah. So I took advantage of that, got some good leads, but it was actually me networking in that class and found out about this company called Orion. Okay. Orion helps veterans transition to the civilian world and trying to match up their skills and job sets in the military to what may work on the outside. So, and then I got in touch with pretty much a recruiter / I don't like this. Oh, I would say a person that kind of like is your one-on-one, your handler who understands where you came from and what jobs are out there.
Okay. Yeah. Good. Good. So the networking and you found Orion, which sounds like a, you know, military transition job shop, helpful headhunter. It's, you know, that's not a great term anymore, I guess.
Yeah.
but they know that military veterans have value and they're trying to link them up with employers that are looking for military veterans. So you more great wisdom and insight. If you can find one of these sort of companies and they're out there, they're for sure out there. That are specialized and know exactly what you do, nuclear power in this case, where did they guide you? Like, what sort of interviews did you have through Orion?
Through Orion, actually, what we went through or what I went through was quite familiar to, like, I listened to one of your earlier episodes, and was the episode with the young lady. I forgot her name. But when she described what helped her, I went through the similar process. Orion took me to one of these, a conference where they had brought in multiple employers. And what do you do all day is just sit and go from room to room and interview with different companies. Orion set me up with from people from the steel industry, nuclear power, water treatment, even a company that actually developed or built medical devices. And that's where it's all started from. And I just did interviews. And, you know, from the interviews, they come back, you know, midway and give you your grade on which company like you. And then they say, you know, here's the potential. They want to, you know, want a second interview. So we're, you know, send you over to their facility. And that's where it is. I went to three companies and I chose out of the gate. This is going to be kind of disturbing to some of my friends who I didn't keep in touch with. I kind of wanted to stay away from nuclear power when I first got out. So I took a job with a company called Giddings & Lewis. It was a custom CNC type machine operation out of Fond du Lac, Wisconsin. They built these enormous lathes or vertical mills that makes big components for different customers that they have, like Caterpillar or even go down to they built stuff for Harley Davidson. But I took a job with them because it was a smaller company. They kind of like fell in love with me. I fell in love with them. And what I was going to be is like a kind of like an Army Swiss knife kind of guy. I was going to be a field service person, but I could work on things from electrical to the mechanical side, and also I would do brand new installs for customers. So that was what intrigued me most of anything, and that's why I took the job with them. So Giddings & Lewis, which is now Fives Giddings & Lewis, that got bought out by, I believe, a German company over the years. But I worked for them for the first 3 years when I got out of the Navy.
Interesting. And knowing what I know about you now, I can see how that makes sense, because you're like a constant learner. And you're like, I've learned a lot about the nuclear power industry. What's next? Oh, let's try something entirely new. Let's try machine tools and vertical milling machines and you know, the whole gambit, which, you know, drew on your Navy experience too, because the Navy doesn't teach you just one thing. It teaches you how the whole system works together. So a couple things to highlight the interview process. I did something similar. Mm-hmm. I went through a company called Career Development, and they lined me up with, I don't know, like six speed dating interviews, like a half an hour, 45 minutes a piece in an embassy suites. And you just go from one to one to one. And, you know, you may do six or eight in a day, and then you have a few options. So sounds like you went through a similar process. I'm guessing there are similar things happening today. And Rachel Johnson is from episode 17, actually Navy Aviation, went through a similar thing. So she perhaps got a contact out of the TAPS class, or I think I remember she might have had a manager or a senior person that she had worked for in the Navy transition before she did, and kind of like pulled her along a little bit. But either way, it's networking and figuring out your options. Okay, so Giddings & Lewis, and you did that for 3 years, and where'd you segue after that? Was that into Bridgestone?
Yep, that's where I segued into Bridgestone. Giddings & Lewis was downsizing, and they loved me, but they said, you know, one of those old school things. They say, you know, one of the last hired first, all right. But
last in, first out,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. So, but I mean, it was a good 3 years of a little bit of travel and learning, like you said, learning something different and new, and then I went back to another company, not Orion, but a company. It might have been that company you just mentioned. And I did the whole process, that same process that got me to get into the Lewis job. I did the same thing and ended up linking up with the headhunter that was interested in positioning me with Bridgestone. Now, the main reason, it wasn't anything about tire manufacturer, anything else, was that it was going to bring me back closer to home. It was going to bring me like within 45 minutes from home where I grew up. And that was going to be a no brainer no matter what. And I was going to take that job anyway.
Not a big fan of the Wisconsin winters, were you?
No, actually.
You didn't mind? Yeah.
No, I didn't mind it, but I didn't have to stay there. I actually was back then. I was one of those original remote workers.
Okay, gotcha. Got field guy, right?
Yeah. I still lived and worked. I was still living in Hampton, Virginia, where I had gotten out of the Navy at. And I was still living there, working from there. Yeah.
Gotcha. Fantastic. And that was, you described part of your Bridgestone experience already. You made it up through the ranks and you did a lot of different things within the organization over 18 years. Anything else that we missed on the Bridgestone side? Sounds like you had a great experience there.
No. It's just one thing I'll mention this part for veterans maybe getting out, you know, now. And for my nukes that are possibly getting out, I realized when I didn't play much into that area in Giddings and Lewis, but when I went to Bridgestone, I realized that everything isn't procedural based. You know, coming from the Navy, you were all about SOP, standard operating procedures. And realizing that when you come out of the military and go in the civilian world, some places you're gonna get hit with, they don't run that way, and you're like wonder why. But I learned that, but I was able to later on in my time at Bridgestone kind of help them incorporate a little bit of that in the culture, which is just one thing I want to bring about Bridgestone. But no, they laid the foundation for my maintenance and reliability, you know, my stint through it. It was just one of those things that you know, you realize when you separate from the military, one of the things you're like, that's, you know, when I was in the military, you're like, God, this paperwork is kind of gets to me. But I'll be darned if you got out and then you get in, you're like, all right, where's the procedure for me to take this cylinder off this? You know, how we don't have it, but we just do it by, you know, good old knowledge, you know, good old street knowledge, I call it. Like what, you know, and then I had to learn. I had to take a step back in because the very first thing, you know, that we all acquainted with in the Navy was safety, and the safety aspect of things was quite different from civilian to military. You know, I'm used to two person tag out, lock out, tag out. And then, you know, they're just lock it out at your own, you know, at a whim. In some places, and I'm not saying all, but some places, those are a couple of things and adjustments when I got to Bridgestone was when I coincided military to civilian life, how safety is treated a little different, and also how, you know, standard operating procedures is not on the hierarchy when it comes to some things.
Great points. So you got to be, you got to go in eyes wide open, right? Because I mean, exactly. In the military, you know, you fail something on an aircraft carrier on a submarine, I mean, could cause 2,000 people to get blown up, right?
Right.
You know, or you're dead in the water and you're a giant target that is a high value asset to the country and towards a war effort. So when you get into a plant, it's not necessarily life or death, but the safety side of it, when you're dealing with high pressure hydraulics, high pressure air, high pressure anything, you can get hurt really, really fast. And people do, right? Mm-hmm. And people do. And you don't hear about it on the nightly news or anything like that. But, you know, steel mills, tire plants, that type of thing, they can be very dangerous. So getting your head around being part of an organization that you know, can put somebody down, and out, I should say, it could really hurt somebody. And not having the same sort of procedures might be like cause to say, I'm out of here, right? Screw this. This is crazy. Whereas It sounds like you sort of eased yourself into the program and said, okay, well, here's a place where we probably really, really need this, because if we don't do it, somebody's going to get killed, and it's safety and all that. Whereas maybe some of the other parts are just excessive. I don't know, but you had the chance to check it out and apply the skill that you learned in the Navy. Yeah, I miss some of those SOPs too. I look for those and in the world of scuba diving, which I'm in now, because that's what I enjoy doing. We have the internet in videos where people show you how to do everything and all that. So that's quite helpful. But back then that was not a thing. Right. You also mentioned Amazon. What did you do for Amazon before you, was that the last job in corporate America before you went out on your own?
No, there was a few jobs in between Bridgestone and Amazon, but Amazon was the last job before I went out on my own. Because I tell this joke with my wife, hopefully I'm not upsetting her, but I felt like I became a millennial, because we like to joke that I did 18 years, and then all of a sudden I took a job with, I don't know if you're familiar with a place called Savannah Riverside.
It sounds familiar, but you'd have to refresh my memory.
Let's just keep it as, it's a place where we keep some of our country's nastiest radioactive waste from the production of nuclear warheads back in the day. And it's also a place, you can look this up, it's also a place that was in discussion where weapons-grade plutonium is actually stored. This is a place you just look, yeah, it's a place here right in Aiken. But I took a job there doing maintenance and reliability. Now, this is after I left Bridgestone, because I felt I had topped myself out. And when it comes to maintenance, you can either become a maintenance manager, and that's it. And I was right up against it, and I had no wishes to become the maintenance manager there. So, but I wanted to keep growing and, you know, actually learned about something else. So I moved on to Savannah Riverside, where I took a job in doing what I've done all the time. But there was actually looking at the equipment that keeps things working and operating, actually took me back to the glory days of the Navy, because the technology actually goes back to the 50s and 60s inside that place. So it was interesting. But what I did there was help them institute or try to bring about new technologies in monitoring the equipment they have there. And I worked there for about a year and a half. That's where the joke comes in. I became a millennial because I started job hopping after Bridgestone. I actually went from Savannah Riverside, then I went to a startup company that develops wireless vibration sensors. I worked for them, did pretty much project management type stuff, and I was a vibration analyst, and I helped them do a very large install at FedEx in Memphis, Tennessee, which at their large airport hub. We install a large amount of sensors there to monitor their conveyance system, which is incredible to see in operation. And you understand how you get your package in a couple of days. Mm-hmm. Fascinating operation. But I worked for them once again. I worked for them for about a year and a half doing that. And then I went on to, I like to joke and say, I went and joined the behemoth, Amazon. And with Amazon, I was a predictive maintenance analyst. But quickly, and within a month's time, I became part of a team, which is called RME, Reliability Maintenance and Engineering. And me and a couple other guys were in charge of deploying what Amazon had just developed, their own wireless vibration sensor throughout their network. So with them, I worked for them for about, a lot of people thought this was funny, I worked with them for about 6 months. But in that 6 months, I think I racked up a whole bunch of airline flights. So it was a lot of travel with that.
Well, I've heard that, Amazon likes veterans, but it's a grind if you get in there, so beware. But it sounds like you learned some stuff and met some cool people too. Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, they do, and I guess not to say it is very veteran friendly, but they like it's like they understand where we came from, and so they're willing. In my humble opinion, they are willing to give you a ton of responsibility, you know, as in being a brand new hire. So to anybody who's looking or possibly going to join Amazon in the next coming, if they listen to this and they hear, be ready because they're going to challenge you. They have no qualms about challenging you. And when you're coming in as a veteran, which I applaud and I celebrate that.
Well, and that sounds like not the normal or not the typical experience for veterans getting out and getting an organization more. They're more likely to not understand what a veteran brings to the table than giving people responsibility fast because they know where you've been. So, yeah, goods and bads with everything, I guess. I love the millennial comment. My brain automatically went to, you know, becoming a digital, like more of a digital native, but that's not what you meant at all, which is, this is great insight for the show, because I think for the Gen Xers around, even, you know, other folks who aren't millennials, perhaps, well, Gen Y and then Gen Y is millennial, and then Gen Z is my kids, right, who are 15 and 16. But, it's not against the law to go from an organization where you're at for a year and a half, 2-3 years to another one, but in gain experience, it's not necessarily disloyal. I mean, hell, if you start in a company and you're there for a long time, you were at Bridgestone for 18 years. I was with Valvoline for 13 years. I mean, sometimes you can get, you know, in a place where there's nowhere else to go, right? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, something happens along the way. But in any case, it is definitely something I think that's more acceptable and perhaps encouraged these days is to make your way around, especially between your 20s and 30s. I mean, once you get more established, then you can kind of pick and choose a little bit more what you do. But yeah, great. Great insight. And now, how's running your own business? I mean, you like took the leap. You're like, I'm good. I'm just going to do this on my own. I'm ready. I like helping people. How long have you been running the business? And where's the name come from, by the way, too? Faithful Reliability.
Well, Faithful Reliability comes in a large part of my faith, belief in God and my heart. But reliability also goes back to maintenance and reliability. And most people, I was always thinking that just to say something that's connected to the industry, but in essence, is all does go around my faith. Just believe. I believe what I've learned can help, and I believe in helping. And I'm gonna be reliable. You can rely on me to give you the best knowledge that I have, and trust that I will give you the best.
Tremendous name. Did you come up with it on your own, or did you spend $1,000 to have some marketing company come up with it?
By myself.
Nice. Yeah. Fantastic. And how long have you been running it now?
Oh, I've been doing it just 2 years.
2 years. Okay.
2 years.
And everything's okay. You've got enough business. You're staying busy, as busy as you want to be.
As busy as I want to be, because of this, like, I mean, I would want to say this in this quarter of my life, my little brother and I joke on each other. We like to say that, you know, I'm in the fourth quarter of my life. I don't think I'm that late, but anyway, we're in the fourth quarter. This quarter, I've, you know, between making some pretty good financial decisions in the past, and as I don't have to work as much, or I don't have to be work as much or have much work as I needed before. And I can select what I want to do right now. And then, like I said earlier, I select few customers. And like I said, I don't want to get bogged down with going out and doing inspections, but I love it. I love doing inspections. But like I said, I'd rather teach you, you know, to be able to fish instead of you just getting your fish to you. But yeah, it's fine. The first year is what I was told was going to happen. You're going to learn more about business than you got your niche in your industry is fine. What you're going to learn by running your own business is that some of this stuff should be taught in school. There's things that they've never told you need to know running your own business. Like, you know, you're going into certain places, you need different insurances. It's amazing how many different insurances I need as a single person to touch another person or another entity's equipment to protect them and protect myself. You got to understand if you're going to be a sole proprietor, or one day, do you want to grow the company and hire anybody? All these kind of things that you don't get taught. You just kind of learn on the whim, which I think that, you know, I tried to go through some mentorships, but what I was looking for, I didn't find. I wanted to find, I'm going to be biased. I wanted to find other veterans that had run businesses, and it was hard for me to find them out there to try to jump on and ask them questions about running a business. So, you know, a lot of trials and errors with the backside of a business. That was the only thing. But my good friend told me the predictive technologies, condition-based monitoring, that comes easy for me, but the business side is the hard part.
Right on. Well, I think we're going to be back to back with veteran business owners. We just interviewed Laura Hatcher, who is also a Navy veteran, and she runs her own photography business. So that hasn't been published yet, but it'll probably come out right before yours. It's on deck, so to speak. So she had some interesting stories about starting up her business, and I think she did it during COVID. You've been doing it for a couple of years, so it's 2025. So just after COVID, it sounds like you started up your program, and it's great. Glad to hear you're doing well. Are you involved in Society of Maintenance and Reliability Professionals, SMRP, and all that, or any other reliability societies that are out there where people see you at a show once in a while or gatherings?
No, I stay on the backside of the SMRP. I know a ton of people in it. I want to. It's right now is I guess it's hard to describe how I feel about some of the things that are out there. But one of the main groups I like going to the conferences, but I haven't gone as Faithful Liability. If I go now, I still go as Kelvin Gardner. I haven't gone as Faithful Liability, and I just like to still take the conference as an individual, as learning. But
yeah, that's cool. Well, mainly
I'm part of Vibration Institute. Okay. I'm staying close to what I've known a lot more of, vibration analysis and stuff like that. And I'm trying to stay more involved in the what we call the Piedmont chapter here in South Carolina and the North Carolina area. So It's kind of hard to get to go to a lot of the conferences being, you know, solopreneur because of the cost. But I talked to a lot of people who've gone and they say, hey, you missed a good one. I'm like, oh, well, I'll check it out later. But, you know, I just.
Yeah. No judgment here. I mean, all the time that I spent in SMRP, it was always sponsored by the organization. Okay. And the travel was always sponsored by the organizations that I was working for. So I got a free ride, so to speak, and wasn't doing it as a solopreneur. I like that terminology too. Well, Kelvin, we've got a couple more questions before we start to close this out. And we've talked about some of this, but do you have any advice that you would give to a service member planning to transition to the civilian world, that you wish you had when you made that move?
Yeah, I think you kind of touched on one of them coming out. The biggest one is keeping your eyes open and understanding it doesn't, in different industries, it doesn't correlate your experiences don't correlate on the surface, but at the root of everything, your experiences are definitely going to be the foundation for some of these industries. And I know it's been years since I've been out, and I don't know if it still plays. Don't be afraid. Go ahead. If you're ready to transition out, transition. I like to say, don't be fed by the fear mongers. Like, hey, there's nothing out there. The job industry is drying up. Your experiences, your training are valuable. You just have to find the proper place to place them. And like you said, that part of, like, you know, joking about being a millennial, it might take you a couple jobs. But the one thing to know, and like my daughter and her friends and my son like to say, they call it code switching. This terminology, they call it code switching, which is kind of like, I feel like when you're going from the military to civilian, you'd be calling code switching. In my essence, I always thought that you can be a chameleon. I feel like, especially from the Navy nuke world, you have the ability, and what we used to call it is adapt to different scenarios and situations. Now they want to call it code switching or being a chameleon, but that's all it is now. Your training and experiences will allow you to adapt to different situations. Don't let your military job paint you into a corner that has to be the only job that or facet of world that you can work in. The world is your oyster. You can do more than what you did in the military. Take the foundation from the military, not your actual job. Take the foundational experiences and knowledge and take that into the civilian world. I wish someone had told me that, you know, instead of it had to be pinpoint what you used to do.
Beautiful. Well said. I think we can write that down somewhere and pass it around. Thank you, Calvin. Beautiful. So moving on to the corporate hiring managers, anybody in a corporation who's looking for veterans, what do they need to know to get the best military fits for the positions they're seeking to fill, in your opinion?
In my opinion, this is the question I fight with with a couple people, because I know a lot of guys that do hiring. First and foremost, stay away from the scripted questions. You're not gonna find any depth or find out exactly what that veteran can bring to your company, your organization, your family, whatever. Stay away from the scripted questions. You have to go a little bit deeper with a veteran, because some of your episodes have already talked about this. It's hard to correlate what we did or what we experienced in the military and make it resonate or be visual in the civilian world. So to my plea to the hiring managers or corporate people is to be more creative, be more elaborate in your questioning in these job interviews, and stop sending it's going to sound kind of harsh, but stop sending those scripted HR questions in and being your right off the bat. You're going to have to be more creative. And especially if you see they are a veteran, know that you're going to have to be more creative with your questions to get to know them in that short period of time, and also to build see if what they know or what they've done fits your culture or your organization.
Spot on. I love it. And passion as well behind it. Yeah, you've been there before. You've done this. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Me too. Me too. Gotta love those scripted HR questions. Tell me about a time. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So Calvin, is there anything we didn't cover today that you wanted to relate to listeners, either vets or those looking to connect with them? Anything we left out?
No. I don't think there's anything. It's just that I don't know. As a veteran about to get out, don't be afraid to ask for help. Let's go with that one. The biggest one is don't ask for it. Be with the job, be with finances, anything. Don't be afraid to go ask for help. You know. I know
you are not alone.
You're not alone. You are not alone.
And there are plenty of people like us that are willing to help, right?
Exactly.
I mean, the last thing you can do is like, oh, I'm a veteran. I can do everything. I'm expected to do everything. And then it doesn't start working out. Then you start feeling sorry for yourself and tipping back the bottle and, you know, it doesn't go any better from there. So along those lines, how would people get a hold of you if they wanted to talk to you and pick your brain a little bit, Kelvin? After that?
They can find me on LinkedIn or at faithforreliability.com, my website. My wife probably killed me if I give up my phone number, but.
No, it's okay. LinkedIn's pretty accessible.
Yeah.
And, you can send messages there, connect there,
sure,
and get in contact. And if it goes to the next step, then you can share your phone number. So don't feel pressured to do that, but thank you for being willing to talk to people and share your story, because I mean, everybody has a story, and yours is,
yes,
super interesting. And I think very, very helpful, for, our folks, our listening audience, both veterans and people trying to hire him. So I really sincerely appreciate you taking the time to talk to me and help us on this mission. Just a quick note to our listeners, we're seeking both women veterans as well as recently transitioned vets to round out our show. Thank you, Kelvin, and thank you to MOBIS for providing this platform to help both transitioning vets as well as those looking to hire them in the field of maintenance and reliability. I really appreciate it, Kelvin. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Veterans Connected. We'll see you back for another episode very soon. In the meantime, we hope to see you in the Veterans Connected community group, where you can meet Eric and fellow podcast guests and share with other industry veterans at MOBIUSConnect.com. We hope to see you there.